Welcome to the second edition of the Diplomats U.S. Teams podcast. I'm Zachary Keck in Washington.
And I'm Ankit Panda, reporting from New York City.
Just to recap briefly from last week, the Diplomat has recently got into the podcast game. Our Tokyo team will be doing podcasts, focusing more on cultural issues in the Asia-Pacific. Ankit and I, meanwhile, will be discussing mostly defense and foreign policy issues. Last week, for instance, we discussed some of the changes taking place in U.S. policy towards Asia. And this week, we thought we'd devote the podcast to the recent terrorist attacks in China, as well as some of the developments taking place on the Korean Peninsula. As always, we appreciate feedback from listeners, which they can leave in the comments section. And you can also include in these feedback is what topics you'd like to see us discuss, or any guests you'd like to see us join us on the podcast. So without further ado, Ankit, why don't you get started by giving us some background on the attacks in China this weekend.
Absolutely. Yeah, so over the weekend, there was a deadly terrorist attack in China, in Kunming, actually, where 29 people were killed and over 140 were injured in a horrific attack by knife-wielding assailants. So far, no group has taken responsibility, but reports by China's official Xinhua news agency have strongly implied that these are by agents based in Xinjiang. China did not actively call out any Uyghur groups, but they essentially implied that, you know, these were groups that were based in Xinjiang. So in response to the attacks, which are some of the deadliest that China has faced in recent memory, I think China's public security apparatus is looking to is going to start to get a lot larger across the country. President Xi has already declared that China will clamp down on violent terrorist activities across the country. And additionally, China's Minister of Public Security, Guo Shengkun, and the head of the Commission for Political and Legal Affairs have both decided to coordinate efforts to deal with the incident. So it looks like this is going to be somewhat of a watershed event in terms of China's internal security policy. Zach, so where do you see this? What do you see this leading to in terms of how China might revise its domestic security apparatus?
Well, it's sort of early to say right now, of course. One thing I thought that was interesting in China's domestic coverage of the attacks is that they really tried to tamper down on the ethnic implications of this. They were trying to portray it as isolated Uyghurs instead of saying, like, you know, Uyghurs are all terrorist attacks. It's almost like what George Bush tried to do right after 9/11, where he downplayed. He said U.S., you know, is a friend of Islam. This wasn't Muslims attacking the U.S. in sort of a clash of civilizations. It was just an isolated group of radical Muslims. So I thought that was interesting. It portends that they're not going to try to play the ethnic angle. Besides that, ultimately, I think one thing that we should be remarked is tactically, this was definitely a huge tragedy, but from a tactical standpoint from the terrorists, is that they killed 29, there was 8 attackers, they killed 29 people and injured 143. That means they killed, basically, each attacker killed on average nearly 4 people, and they injured however many, over 10 a piece besides the 4 they killed. I mean, that was just a huge surprise. Usually with knife attacks, it's hard to kill that many people because people can overpower someone holding a knife. Even just like a semi-automatic shotgun, a lot of these school shootings in the U.S. with non-semi-automatic shotguns, they kill like 1 or 2 people maybe, but then usually the person wielding the gun is like taken down. So, I mean, I just thought that was shocking. That was the first thing that stood out to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, 4 of the attackers actually killed at the scene. But yeah, that's still an incredible death toll for a knife-based attack. To go back to the point on the ethnic angle, it's actually, you know, like, the central government has a lot to lose by playing that up. So I think it makes perfect sense for them to not play that up at this point, because that would just serve to inflame tensions in Xinjiang, which is the last thing China wants at this point. Go ahead.
No, you go.
So if you think about the Xinjiang legislatures, you know, a security legislature, I think, you know, that will be a lot likely to pass now. And I think in the long run, we might see more a greater central security presence over in Xinjiang, which is already pretty large.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's definitely possible. And the only thing I would say with the ethnic is, like, if this wasn't Uyghurs, like, I think they would say it was anyways, just because I don't think they... I think they want to portray this as these terrorist attacks rather than discontent Chinese. I'm not saying... I think it probably is the Uyghur, what is the group called? The East Turkestan?
East Turkestan Islamic Movement, yeah.
But I do think they would want to portray this as, you know, someone from that group rather than ethnic Han, because I think ethnic Han Chinese, if it's just general discontent, then that's going to be a real problem for the central government. But I do agree that they don't want to isolate the Uyghurs and spark radical tension and stuff, so...
Yeah. I mean, so after the Tiananmen Square attacks last year, Etim took about a month to claim responsibility. So it might be the case again that that's what's happening if they are the perpetrators in this case. But also I think, you know, to go back to the tactical angle of this terrorist attack, I think in one way, you know, it kind of served its purpose of making Chinese citizens feel unsafe as far east as Kunming. The attack in Beijing also served to that. So now, you know, there might be this perception across China just by normal citizens that they aren't as safe as they previously thought they were. And that might, in fact, allow the central government to, you know, install public security apparatus without much opposition. If you look at the reaction across Chinese social media, our colleague Shannon has a great article on this, actually, looking at the comparisons of this Kunming knife attack to a 9/11, obviously not in terms of death toll and actual a spectacle, but in terms of the effect this might have on security policy. And a lot of Chinese social media users were making that comparison and claiming that this would be, you know, what sort of begins a major clampdown by the central government in terms of security.
Yeah, I think the comparisons, we'll see, but I think the comparisons could be overblown. First of all, just the differences in casualties are just huge, but then also one thing that was significant about 9/11 is the tactical use of, like, airplanes, which, you know, had a whole industry that wasn't that regulated before, became really regulated. As far as knives go, I mean, what are they going to ban all? They can't really ban all knives in China, obviously. You know? So, yeah, but overall, I think we just got to wait to see how this plays out. One thing I just hope that we don't see, which we saw with the Tiananmen Square thing, was this people in the West, especially in the U.S. and stuff, they try to... This isn't necessarily terrorism because the Uyghurs are oppressed in China. I mean, I hate to see that. I think that's ridiculous. We had an interesting piece on The Diplomat was like, call the Tiananmen Square attack what it is, terrorism. And I just think I agree with that line completely. Terrorism's a tactic. Al-Qaeda claimed they had grievances against the U.S., I'm not saying Uyghurs don't have grievances against China. I think they do, but you can't use terrorism. We can't justify terrorism based on grievances. Otherwise, every group in the world would be allowed to use terrorism.
Absolutely. Actually, I mean, I already noticed that this time. A lot of the initial news coverage, you know, referred to the attackers as assailants or attackers, and the word terror, if it was used in some of these articles, was used only when they were quoting Xinhua, never by the text of the actual articles themselves. So I think that that still exists a bit, and I agree with you that it's troubling.
Yeah. So, well, with that, Don, you want to move on to North Korea?
Yeah, absolutely.
Speaking of terrorism.
Yeah. You know, our favorite neighborhood troublemaker in Northeast Asia, North Korea. Over the past month, diplomacy, not just between the two Koreas, but also between the United States and North Korea and China, has been getting quite interesting. And there's a lot of things on the horizon right now. You know, North Korea is kind of on a charm offensive towards the South, although, you know, a series of provocations last week have slightly challenged that, but, you know, Zach, you can tell us more about that later. So I'll just start off by covering, you know, what's been going on between the United States and North Korea. So the six-party talks, you know, broke down in 2009. The last time the six parties actually met was in 2008. So we're looking at, we're about 6 years out now from when the six-party talks last took place. And I wrote a piece in The Diplomat last Friday just looking at the developments and seeing, you know, how likely it is that the six-party talks could reconvene this year. There are some encouraging signs, particularly from Pyongyang and Beijing. So Beijing has been a huge proponent of returning to the six-party talks under the guise of, you know, denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula. For China, if it's successful in bringing everybody back to the six-party talks, that's kind of very good in terms of making it look like a regional leader, giving it some clout in that regard. So North Korea is notoriously difficult to read, but we do have a few indicators that they might be interested. So the North Korean ambassador to Beijing, according to a tweet of all things by Xinhua News Agency, said that they're interested in in resuming the six-party talks, provided that the U.S. fulfill its related obligations. U.S. policy towards North Korea still hasn't changed, and it looks like the North Koreans might be, you know, trying to isolate the U.S. right now. So Glenn Davies, who's the special representative for North Korea in the State Department, rebuffed any indication that the six-party talks would take place, provided that North Korea doesn't make any sort of a major provocation. But he also called for a change in North Korea's policy direction, implying that, you know, North Korea might have to make an overture to the IAEA. And later, Assistant Secretary of State Daniel Russell clarified a saying that the negotiations could never take place if the DPRK doesn't accede to the terms of the 2005 joint statement that North Korea, the United States, and South Korea all signed at the six-party talks. Now, just to clarify, this joint statement, as part of that, Kim Jong-il committed to abandoning all nuclear weapons and existing nuclear programs and returning at an early date to the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons and to IAEA safeguards. So that's a tall order right now for Kim Jong-un and the DPRK to agree to, so I think that's highly unlikely. Zach, do you want to tell us a bit about inter-Korean relations at this point?
Yeah, so there's been a mix, basically, between provocations and some conciliatory action. North Korea, as far as it provoking South Korea, it had a naval incursion. It went across the DMZ, the maritime DMZ, last week, briefly for 3 hours or so, and then returned back. And then it also fired what was first, the news media first said was 4 short-range rockets on Friday, I believe, or Thursday, into the East China Sea, and then on Monday, it might have it fired some more, and now some news media is reporting that those are actually Scud missiles, which are a little longer range. I think they go up to 700 kilometers, and then some Korean media, local media, is saying that they were actually multiple rocket launchers, new 300 millimeter rocket launchers, which would be troubling for South Korea because they don't have any sort of defenses for these things. The rocket launchers are troubling because they fire like rapidly and they have poor accuracy, but there's not really any sort of intercepting missile defense system for them, where South Korea has some missile defense for actual rockets. So that's troubling for South Korea. At the same time, North Korea has also been allowed the family reunions to go through, despite South Korea and U.S. joint military drills, which started last month. It also has started a 3 day of talks with Japan's Red Cross agency in China. Those talks are aimed at recovering Japanese soldiers whose remains are still in North Korea from World War II and from Japan's colonialization, and then also possibly talks about releasing the Japanese citizens that were abducted by North Korea during the 80s, which is really Japan's main concern. So I guess, what is your take on this, like, half-provoking South Korea and half-conciliatorial?
I think, you know, part of it is that Kim Jong-un's hands are partly tied, because appearing to be fully conciliatory to North Korea would be a major policy shift for the North. I do think that, economic concerns are starting to play up a bit for the North in a way that they haven't maybe in Kim Jong-un's first few years in power. I think this year that's going to be kind of a major motivator for North Korean policy. You know, we saw an article earlier in The Diplomat from actually an author who was in North Korea talking about how the Chinese investment climate is starting to change there, that North Korea's Chinese cash cow is starting to kind of wither away, and I think that kind of conditions the North's behavior in more ways than people generally like to acknowledge. I think we're kind of at a very delicate junction right now with the North. I think a lot of it is going to come down to if China can truly begin to condition the North again. After, you know, Jang Song-taek's execution in December, a lot of analysts kind of made a big deal out of the fact that, you know, this guy was China's man in Pyongyang, and now that he is out of the picture, China has way less influence over Pyongyang. So earlier this month, actually, the Chinese vice foreign minister engaged in a little bit of shuttle diplomacy. He made back-to-back trips between Pyongyang and Seoul, almost overlapping with John Kerry in Seoul, actually. And I think that China is trying to play mediator right now between North and South Korea. And I think provocations will continue, but I think that this could be a promising year in terms of inter-Korean relations. A lot of it will also depend on, you know, what President Park is interested in doing in the South. For example, when the North held the high-level talks earlier this month without any pre-planned agenda, a lot of the South Korean negotiators were kind of taken aback. They called it a pleasant surprise. But, you know, we again have to be careful. North Korea might be playing its usual games, as they have done in the past. Even if they come to the negotiating table, it might simply be to wean some more food aid off the international community and go back to, you know, a nuclear test a few months later. So it's anyone's guess at this point.
Yeah, I would just emphasize, as far as the China line goes, they said you were talking about Jiang being purged and how he was the main interlocker with China. But actually, the first trade data for the first quarter of this year came back based on China's customs, and the trade actually was stable. But a lot of North Korean analysts or Korean analysts said that they expected this to decline now in the second quarter of this year because some of the contracts were a lot of the contracts between North Korea and China were six month contracts. So
right,
Jiang was purged last fall. So if the contracts run out, they'd be starting up in the second quarter this year. So I think part of the reason why North Korea is reaching out to South Korea and Japan and China is because they realize that if they want to take action on the China side, they're going to need aid from other people or economic support from other countries. So I think you're right there. But I do see the main rationale of North Korea. A few weeks ago, I thought it was they were laying the groundwork for another round of provocations. But I think this time it seems clear now that what they're trying to do is isolate the U.S. Like you were mentioning, Ankit, the U.S. is taking this line that North Korea has to have real positive action to show it's serious about getting rid of its nuclear program before these six-party talks can start again. And although right now the U.S. and South Korea and I believe even Japan are united in this line that some action has to be taken before the six-party talks will start up, I think North Korea knows full well that South Korea's domestic politics won't allow them to continue to hold this line if in the face of a charm offensive from North Korea. So I think North Korea will continue its charm offensive and try to isolate the U.S. So the U.S. is the only country that's saying no to restarting six-party talks because North Korea hasn't done anything positive, and that will make it look like the U.S.'s fault that South Korea or six-party talks haven't started again.
Absolutely. You know, there are also I've been hearing rumors that Kim Jong-un might be preparing for his first international trip to Beijing, which could again be a hugely interesting signal as far as North Korea-China relations go.
It'd be huge, I would say. Kim Jong-un's been trying to get this trip to Beijing for a while now, and China's really resisted, from everything I've heard, at least. So if China allowed that, again, I think China has an interest, too, in isolating the U.S., obviously. Maybe not so much with Japan, but it did allow the Japan's North Korea talks to be held in China, but I know it definitely wants to isolate the U.S. from South Korea, so I mean, I could see North Korea and China having this common interest to isolate the U.S. and them pushing it forward. But I'm not sure talks will resume in this year. It's hard to say always, but I think the U.S. is going to try to hold this line.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the U.S. is going to hold it. Also, you know, you have to consider that the Obama administration just expended so much diplomatic and political capital on the entire Iran process. Starting up negotiations with North Korea might just be too much.
Yeah, I think that's a great point.
A lot of domestic political groups in the U.S.
Yeah, and North Korea actually just sent an envoy to Iran last month sometime. So we'll keep watching this, but I don't know if there's really much. It's just been interesting to see all the developments, but I don't know how much we can make out of any one thing right now.
Absolutely.
So,
I think that brings us to the end of our second podcast on Asia-Pacific security and defense issues. Thanks for listening, and leave your impressions in the comments, any guests and topics you'd like to see in the future.
Yep, and we'll be on next week.
All right, see you then.